thank you so much for the invitation. It's great to be here. What I'm going to tell you about today is some work on the structure of the activity in the cortex. So the cortex, as humans, is something we're rather proud of, because it's what we think makes us special. The cortex is responsible for our most skilled abilities, language, learning, etc. But in fact, the circuits of the cortex, although they're greatly expanded in humans, the circuit diagram, the basic wiring of the cortex, is essentially the same in nearly all mammalian species. So what that suggests is, as well as being similar between different cortical areas, so what that suggests is there might be a single algorithm that different parts of cortex use to process diverse sorts of information. And if we can find out what that algorithm is, we may be able to understand why it sometimes operates suboptimally and how we can make it work better to improve the learning and cognitive performance that we all rely on. I'm a neuroscientist, and the work in my lab consists of a mixture of experimental and theoretical work. What I'm going to tell you about here is a little bit of both. starting with some experimental questions, what is the temporal fine structure of cortical population activity? How are the spikes organized together in time? Second, is this structure fixed or can it vary? When an animal, or indeed a human, is in different circumstances, does the structure of the activity change? Could alterations in the dynamics explain temporal processing deficits in humans? Is it possible that some change in the cortical dynamics could underlie something like language learning impairment? And finally, I want to say something at the end of computational neuroscience, which is really a plug for a poster by Pierre Higer later, on whether we can get model networks of neurons similar to cortical neurons to process speech and to learn to detect different speech words of human speech. Okay, so the first part, what is the fine structure of cortical population activity? And this is work mainly of Arta Lutzak, Shuzo Sakata, and Peter Bartow. Okay, so this is experimental work. It's done in the rat primary auditory cortex, in quietly awake, and sometimes in urethane anesthetized animals. And I'll tell you when it's anesthesia, otherwise assume it won't be. We have very simple stimuli presented through the air from a loudspeaker by free field in a soundproof box. And we record from large neuronal populations with microfabricated electrode arrays. So I want to say just a little bit about the recording methods. So you can buy these electrode arrays and insert them into the brain. Every one of the recording probes has multiple recording sites on it, which send the signal into an amplifier and computer. And because the neurons in the cortex that you're recording from, when they fire an action potential, produce these spatiotemporal electric fields, every one of these sites detects a slightly different pattern of waveform for all the different neurons that might be firing. So with a tetrode, a set of four wires like this one, you can record maybe 10 cells or so. Nowadays, tetrodes are out, and what's in is very high count electrodes, and in fact, there's people now working on electrodes which will be ready in about a year that have 900 sites. And this creates a big challenge, not of the experiment itself, but of the data processing. How are we going to extract the data and find out when the constituent neurons fired that we're recording with this technique? So this gives you a little snippet of some of the raw data recorded from one of these probes. And you can see these events here are the spikes corresponding to the action potentials of the neurons. Different spikes live on different channels and different sets of channels and have different combinations of waveforms. Some are on lots of channels, some on just a few, some on only one. And also, it's the rule now, rather than the exception, that we have different neurons firing at exactly the same time, creating this temporal overlap problem. And this is a difficult problem of signal processing and machine learning to go from this raw data to find out when the spikes actually were. Thanks to some very talented mathematicians, Shabnam and Cyril, we've developed some algorithms which on this high count data are able to do as well as the theoretical optimum we predict based on simulation of the data. This software is all publicly available. So the question though is, why go to all that work? Why do you have to record multiple neurons? Couldn't you do it traditionally, as people always have, one at a time? So here's an example of some data from auditory cortex where we took a population of about 40 neurons that we'd recorded and analyzed four of them individually, the traditional way that you would if you'd only recorded one at a time. And we see exactly the same thing everyone else does. The tone comes on here, it's a very simple tone stimulus on for 1 second. And these two neurons up here have an onset response. They fire when the tone comes on. And sometimes you also see a sustained response. This neuron has only a sustained response. This one has a sustained response and an onset response. It's exactly the same thing everyone else does. And these rasters, I should say, correspond to 100 repetitions of the tone. And the spike times of one of these four neurons in these four blocks are represented by dots for every trial. So this is the same thing everyone else sees when they record one neuron at a time. And if you imagine what the data should look like as a population, it should look like something like this. So this shows what we imagine based on the single cell recordings would be happening at the population level. Here's time and the tone presentation here in blue, the neuron number on the y-axis, so this is now showing one trial, what we think the response of the 40 cells simultaneously would look like. And you see there's a burst at onset, when they the combination of all these onset responses of the cells, after which the cells settle down to tick away at a steady firing rate, with a precise firing rate encoding information about the tone frequency. That's what you would think based on single cell recordings. The actual data looks rather different. So when the tone comes on, you do have a burst of spikes, like you would predict. But in the sustained period of the tone, you don't have this steady activity. You have this complex temporal structure of these repeated bursts, or activity packets, as we call them, that last for about 100 milliseconds, occurring throughout the sustained period of the tone. At the same time, even before the tone was presented, you had this complex temporally structured activity. This was not evoked by any sensory stimulus because it was happening before there was any sensory stimulus at all in complete silence. So what's going on? We know that the tone can evoke activity, but what are these packets of activity doing in silence and in the sustained period? Well, one clue comes from the laminar structure of the cortex. So the cortex has six layers, and different streams of input into the cortex go into different layers. So in the primary sensory cortex, the main sensory input comes from the primary thalamus. So in the auditory system, that would be the ventral medial geniculate nucleus. And it targets two layers, layer 4 and the 5-6 boundary. From layer 4, it's integrated by neurons such as spiny stellate cells or pyramidal cells, which broadcast it to the other layers of the cortex, where it's picked up by a group of cells called the intratelencephalic neurons, which you find in layer 2, 3, and 5, and also in layer 6, although I'm not showing those. And these form the sensory cortex's main output to higher order structures, to the association cortex and also to the striatum. At the same time, there's a different population of cells in the deep part of layer 5, called subcerebral projection neurons, which form the cortex's main output to subcortical structures that are involved in motor behavior, such as the superior colliculus, the brainstem motor structures, or even the spinal cord. And it's important to note that the primary thalamus sends input to layer 4 and to these cells in the deep layers, but not so much to the other layers. There's a bit, but not as much. On the other hand, the other mainstream of input into the cortex is feedback input from higher order cortex and higher order thalamic nuclei. This avoids layer 4 and targets the deep layers, where it synapses strongly onto these subcerebral projection neurons, and also into layer 1, where it has more of a modulatory effect. So it's unlikely that these layer one inputs will drive spiking by themselves, but the layer five inputs will. Okay, a bit of a complicated picture, and that was actually the highly simplified version, but it's enough to let us look at the data and find out something about what's going on with this spontaneous activity. So here's an example of the spike times of a population of neurons now recorded from a laminar electrode in the cortex. Time is on the x-axis, and the vertical location of the neurons is on the y-axis, and every of these ticks is a spike on one trial. There's a click here, and then the rest of the activity is spontaneous. And the first thing you can see is the activity is usually confined to the deep layers. It only occasionally breaks through to the superficial layers, and the sensory activity is in the deep layers, but so is the spontaneous activity, and both of them only occasionally break through to the superficial layers. The interesting thing comes when we look at the temporal dynamics of this activity. So what you see here is four examples of a sensory evoked response and of a spontaneous event, or upstate, as they're often called. You see the time on the x-axis, every dot is a spike, and a vertical location of the cell is on the y-axis. The red curve shows you the mean spike time of onset. And you see the sensory responses have this S shape, which is clearer in the average, which corresponds to the activity starting in layer 4 and at the 5-6 boundary. The spontaneous events, on the other hand, start in the deep layers and go up. They start at the layer 5-6 boundary and propagate up to the rest of the cortex. This exactly matches the picture we got from the anatomy, that the primary inputs target layer 4 and the 5-6 boundary, so are presumably the cause of these sensory responses, or what triggers them, whereas the spontaneous events have exactly the profile you'd expect from something triggered by inputs from higher order structures, a higher order cortex, or thalamus, or perhaps other areas as well. Okay, so there's a few things we've got to explain. Why didn't the data look like this when that's what everyone thought it would look like? So there's a number of specific questions. How come the tone causes, in the single cell level, you think that there's more activity at onset than in the sustained period, whereas when you look at the population, you see these bursts are the same size, whether they occur at the onset or in the sustained period? Well, the answer is because the average over multiple trials isn't just about the firing rate, it's a combination of the firing rate the cell's going to fire at and the probability that it's going to fire. So the answer is that even though the packets of activity occurring in the sustained period are not smaller than the ones at the onset, in fact they're exactly the same size, the sustained activity packets and the onset ones, they occur with a higher probability. The onset of the tone reliably gives you an activity packet, whereas at any point in the sustained period, you're only going to get one with a lower probability. If you get one, it'll be as big, but you're not so likely to get one. So on average, when you look at the average across trials, a traditional analysis, you see this supposed onset response that in a sense wasn't actually there. It's an artifact of the averaging. The other question is how you can have these sustained responses. When you look at the single trial data, the activity is anything but sustained. It has this temporal structure. Why do we have these sustained responses in the average? It's kind of the opposite situation, because these bursts, these activity packets in the sustained period, happen at random times, differently on different trials. When you average over multiple single trials, you get something that looks continuous, even though any single event was not continuous. There's still another question, though, which is how come the cell can respond to its preferred tone with increased spikes? So there are two possibilities. One is that when the neuron hears its preferred tone, it fires spikes that are unrelated to these packets of activity. The other is that the evoked spikes, evoked by the tone, are locked, time-locked, to these activity packets. We can tell these apart using cross-correlation analysis, and the data, I'll skip over the details, but the data supports hypothesis 2, that the evoked spikes are locked to these packets of activity. So the consequence of that is that when the tone comes on, we have a packet of activity that gives you information about what the tone was. And then in the sustained period of the tone, we have these packets of activity whose firing rate encodes information about what tone the animal's hearing. They come at unpredictable times, self-generated by the brain itself. But their firing rate tells you about the tone. Okay, what about the fine temporal structure of these packets? So they're not unstructured, they have a temporal structure. And if we arrange the neurons vertically now, by the latency with which the cells fire within the packets, you can see this diagonal shape, which is occurring because some neurons reliably fire at the beginning of the packets and other ones at the end of the packets. If we look here at two individual neurons, you can see it very clearly. This one, this is now activity triggered by many of, aligned by the onset of these spontaneous packets. This neuron always fires at the beginning, and this neuron always fires at the end. You put all the neurons together, you've got a sequence of activity spreading throughout the cortical population every time one of these packets is triggered. So you might ask whether that's a spatial spread. Is it the case that the reason we have these sequences is because activity is spreading physically across the cortex? So the answer is actually no. So this is an experiment done with a fork electrode with eight shanks inserted into the brain. And you can see that sometimes activity spreads as a traveling wave from one side of the shank to another. Sometimes, but not always. And this is also seen, for example, in voltage-sensitive dye imaging. However, that does not explain the sequential structure that we see. Because if you compensate for the spread of activity across the shanks, and then you realign them, you find that the neurons still have preferred latencies. So what happens is, you can have waves of activity spreading across the cortex, but when the wave gets to one particular place, the neurons always fire with their same sequence, and they'll fire in the same sequence whichever way the wave was going. You can imagine it's a bit like a Mexican wave at a soccer stadium. And when the wave comes around, everybody jumps in the air, but those who are more fit jump up faster than those who are less fit, and they'll do exactly the same thing when a goal is scored in the same sequence. Okay, so what about that was all spontaneous packets. What about the sensory evoked packets? So remember, we have these two types of sensory packets, some that happen at the beginning of the tone and some that happen later in the tone. Let's first deal with the ones that happen at the beginning. If we look at the temporal fine structure of those, we find they last about 100 milliseconds, and their sequential structure is very similar to the spontaneous events. So if we plot the latency of a neuron to one of the spontaneous packets or to the tones or natural sound stimuli, you see a very strong correlation. So the neurons don't have very much freedom in when they're going to fire. If they're going to fire, they usually fire at about the same time. Now, that might sound strange to some of you who will remember experimental evidence for temporal coding, by which I mean the fact that the precise timing of a neuron can vary depending on what the stimulus was. So let me make it clear. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, and it does happen in our data. You can see it here. So this is the spike times of two neurons to different frequencies of tone. You can see that neuron 1 tends to fire a bit earlier to a tone of 7.1 kilohertz or 12 kilohertz than it does to the other frequencies. But the point is that even though you have this dependence on timing on the stimulus, the differences within a cell to different stimuli are much smaller than the differences between cells, even to the same stimulus. So the point is, you've got this conserved packet structure, this conserved sequence that the cells fire in. When a different stimulus comes along, it perturbs it a little bit, but keeping the basic organization the same. It's a variation on a theme. Okay, so that was tones. What about different classes of stimuli? Let's look at natural sounds. In this case, these were frog noises extracted from a CD called Voices of the Swamp. We see this sequence of activity in response to a tone that I showed you earlier. Now, if we look at the same two neurons in response to this frog noise. You can see the frog noise has different syllables. Every one of the syllables triggers the same sequence of activity, approximately the same argument as before. It will be slightly different. There'll be variations on the theme, but it's still basically the same sequence, with these two neurons firing one of them early and the other one late, to every syllable of the frog call. So every syllable of the sound evokes one of these 100 millisecond or so long sequences of activity. In this case, the sequences were evoked by syllables in the sound. But as we saw before, when you have tones, there is no structure in the sound, and the brain has to come up with its own timing mechanism to generate the packets. So we've shown that the firing rates in the sustained period of the tone depend on what the tone frequency is. What about the precise timing within these spontaneous activity packets occurring in the sustained period of the tone? Remember that there's nothing in the tone that evokes this packet. The brain does it by itself. Presumably one of these top-down inputs to the cortex, to the auditory cortex, is triggering the production of one of these packets. What about the timing within one of these self-generated packets? How does it relate to the tone frequency? Well, we can't do the traditional analysis of just looking at the latency relative to the stimulus onset. We need to instead do a cross-correlation analysis. But what you see is, here, this graph shows the cross-correlogram of a neuron with the rest of the population to various different frequencies of tone encoded here in different colors. And you see that the relative timing of the cell differs in a reliable way between different tone frequencies. So these are three different neurons, their responses in the different colors to six different tones, and the solid and dotted lines show you two responses, the response in two halves of the data, just to show it was consistent. So what we see is that these curves have a reliable shape. What that means is, and that's statistically summarized here, that the more similar the tones are, the more similar the temporal fine structure of these spontaneous packets will be. Even though there's a self-generation of the timing, the precise timing of the neurons within the packet depends on the tone frequency. Okay, so to summarize so far, the activity in these quietly resting animals we've been looking at consists of these bursts of activity, these activity packets that last about 100 milliseconds. You have them reliably evoked by the onset of a sound, a tone or a natural sound or any sort of sound. But they can also occur sporadically during these sustained tones and also in silence occur spontaneously. And the firing pattern within one of these packets conveys information about the tone frequency. Both the firing rate of the cells and the precise timing within one of these packets conveys information about what the sound actually was. Okay, so that is the fine structure of the population spiking in these quietly resting animals. And the question, the next question I'd like to talk about is whether this structure is fixed or whether it can vary. And this is work primarily by Alfonso Renart and Jaime de la Rocha. So it's been known for a long time that the cortex can operate in different states. So what we see here is an example of some local field potential recorded from the rat cortex. On the left, we see the pattern characteristic of the synchronized state. We see a large low-frequency oscillation. This is what you find in inalert or sleeping animals. It's got large amplitude, low-frequency LFP, and fluctuations in spiking activity, very variable. On the right is an example of a desynchronized state. This is what you find in awake, attentive, or alert animals and humans. And the amplitude of the LFP or EEG is smaller, but the high frequency power can go up, even though the low frequency power goes down. And you have steadier spiking activity during this type of cortical state. So in our rats, we see a whole continuum of states in between a more desynchronized state, where the fluctuations are smaller, and a synchronized state, which is what I was showing you before, where the fluctuations are less small. And it's not the case that there's a bimodality. This is what people used to think, that when you go from waking to sleep, there's a sudden flick of a switch, and you go from one state straight to the other. That's actually not the case. It's been confirmed by a number of labs now that there's a whole continuum of states in between these two, at least in rodents, and there's good reason to think so in primates and humans also. And that corresponds to our subjective experiences. You know, either we're awake or asleep, but actually sometimes we're half asleep. That's not uncommon. Okay, so what about the fine temporal structure? So this is an example of a population of neurons. Their spike times recorded in the desynchronized state. At the top is the local field potential, at the bottom are the spike times. And you can, if you look very closely at this, you will probably see nothing, because there is no fine temporal structure that's visible to the naked eye. The neurons all appear to be independent of each other. It's actually not quite true. We'll come to why later. But at the first sight, at least there's no correlations in the activity. And the thing about this is that this is something that, according to traditional theories of cortical networks, is completely impossible. So obviously there's a conflict between the data and the theory, so I need to explain a little bit about why that is. The point is there's no global fluctuations in activity, and in particular, there's no correlations between individual cells. The firing of these cells is very uncorrelated and unstructured. How is this even possible? So the point is that it's commonly being believed that when you have two neurons that share a lot of their input, their activity has to be correlated. This is one example of a very influential paper from a couple of decades back now that made the point that when neurons share inputs, their activity has to be correlated, and it makes a lot of sense. And because neighboring cortical cells share a substantial fraction of their inputs, how is it possible they're able to produce this uncorrelated activity? If you make a simple model of two neurons that are getting feed-forward inputs from a population of cells, even though the presynaptic cells are uncorrelated with each other and just firing at random, you will find that the correlation between the neurons is proportional to the number of inputs they share. It makes sense. The presynaptic cell fires a spike, it activates both of the postsynaptic cells. The more inputs they share, the more correlated their activity should be, at least in a feed-forward network. So how is it possible that in the cortex where you share so many inputs, you're able to produce a state with almost no correlation? Because this is what we don't see. So either the theory is wrong or the data is wrong. And we check the data, so it must be the theory. So the answer is that it's actually what was wrong with the theory was it was a feed-forward network. If you make a model of a recurrent cortical network, in particular something with recurrent inhibition, this no longer happens. So I don't have time to go over all the details here, but Alfonso and Jaime developed a mathematical theory of how strong correlations should be in networks that are strongly and densely connected to each other. And what comes out of the mathematics is this prediction that, yes, the common inputs will drive fluctuations in the network, correlated fluctuations, but provided recurrent inhibition is strong and fast enough, it will rapidly squash these correlations and prevent them from getting too large. There's a whole lot of mathematics behind it and a whole lot of simulations, but what's more interesting is that it makes some experimental predictions. So in particular, the theory predicts that you can have a state where the mean correlation is zero, but you can't have a state where every correlation is zero. You're always going to have some neurons that are positively correlated with each other, but they'll be counterbalanced by an equally large number of neurons that are negatively correlated with each other, so the mean is zero. And we'd had this data for a while, and when he came up with this prediction, I thought this is nonsense. We'd known the data, we'd see it if it was there, but then we actually looked in the data for it and found that actually it was true. So what's shown here is the cross correlograms between a set of neurons, and you see that there's certain pairs over here with positive correlations, these peaks in their cross correlograms, but there's as many with negative correlations here with these dips in their cross correlograms. And we hadn't even noticed that until the theory made this prediction, then we went back to the data and looked at it. Okay, so that slight detour explains why you can have this state of very low correlation in the cortex. But what I'd like to talk about is how information about sensory stimuli is encoded in that state. So remember that in this synchronized state, when we had these packets of activity, the tone-evoked spikes were time-locked to the packets. Now in the desynchronized state, where the fluctuations are smaller, what you might predict is the same thing, that as much as there are fluctuations here, that will modulate the timing, the firing of these tone-evoked spikes. But when this is steady activity, there'll be no such modulation. So to test that, what we can do is take packets of activity from the two states and measure the information content in bits about the tone from the firing patterns within these little time windows. And if this hypothesis is true, then the amount of fluctuation, the amount of information should depend only on the firing rate at that time and not on the state. When we do that, we find that that's the case, that the more the cells fire, the more information they convey, which makes sense, because if they don't fire, they can't convey very much information. It's actually not quite true that they convey zero information, because not spiking can tell you something too. But in any case, the more they fire, the more information they can convey. But other than that, there's no difference between the states. Okay, so a lot of data. Let's try and make sense of it. I think we can summarize all of this data by something called the gating hypothesis. And it works as follows. So remember, there are these two streams of input into the cortex. There's the bottom-up sensory drive and the top-down corticocortical inputs, which we believe are responsible for triggering these spontaneous packets. So when there's no sensory stimulus, when there's silence, the corticocortical inputs come along and drive the network to fire. And the information that the auditory cortex is then telling the rest of the brain is just the fact that there is no sensory stimulus. Silence is actually a fairly rare phenomenon, at least where I live. And it's also a very salient phenomenon, as anyone who has kids will tell you. When there's silence, that's actually the thing that you need to worry about most. So this is an important message for the auditory cortex to tell the rest of the brain that there is silence. When a stimulus comes along, like one of these tones, the onset of the tone is very salient. It is enough to drive activity. The burst of activity from the thalamus is enough to drive one of these 100 millisecond packets of activity in the cortex. But the sustained period of the tone is not very salient. When sustained sounds are going on, you ignore them. And in fact, you wouldn't notice there's an air conditioner in this room if you don't stop and listen for it. And there is one. I hadn't noticed until I actually said that. So the point is that the sustained part of a sound, or like a tone or an air conditioner, is not enough to drive the cortex by itself to fire, because the cortex needs a critical mass of activity before it's going to fire. And perhaps the time it is able to fire is when it gets top-down input from, for example, these higher-order cortical structures, which drive one of these packets of activity, and then open a gate that allows the auditory cortex to convey a packet of information to the rest of the brain. One of these packets that lasts 100 milliseconds, and now conveys information that there is a sustained tone, there is an air conditioner, or there is silence. You wouldn't know, and the auditory cortex wouldn't say this unless the rest of the brain asked it to. It's, if you like, a form of attention, but a form of attention that lasts only for 100 milliseconds. In the desynchronized state, which is what you have when animals are tonically alert and aware of their surroundings, then you've got tonic activity. And there's actually now reasons to believe from other labs that in those states, that's caused by a tonic drive from higher order cortex to the sensory cortices, which means the gate is permanently open. And then when this tone comes on, these cells are able to represent not only the onset, but the sustained period faithfully. Okay, so that's the first two parts. Now, the last two will be a bit quicker. And the next thing I'd like to do is try and relate some of this work to some of the other things that are going on in the TDLC, particularly concerning language learning. So is it the case that alterations in cortical dynamics could explain temporal processing deficits in the auditory system? So I'm sure most people here... Oh, and this is the work of Liad Hollander. Now, I'm sure most people here will be familiar with this particular result of Paula, which is that children with language learning impairment, or a risk of language learning impairment, are impaired at fine-scale temporal discrimination. So distinguishing two sounds in very close proximity in the tens to maybe 100 milliseconds is something that they can do much less well than control children, although at long interstimulus intervals, there is no difference in performance. So what this suggests is that language learning impairment, at least in early development, is related or co-occurs with a deficit in temporal processing, particularly in the auditory system. So I'd like to propose a hypothesis for how this, or one potential factor that could contribute to this happening. So remember that we saw that in synchronized states, the cortex generates its own temporal dynamics. It's producing these packets of activity when it feels like it, rather than when the stimulus tells it to. And perhaps this internally generated temporal dynamics of a similar timescale could interfere with the processing of rapid sounds. And what this suggests is it might be that these language learning impaired children are not able to process the temporal fast temporal structure because they're unable to put their auditory cortex in a sufficiently desynchronized state. And I think some work of April's has shown that there are indeed differences in the cortical local EEG patterns of young children who are at risk for language learning impairment, which supports the idea this could possibly be the case. So to test that, let's look at the responses in auditory cortex to single clicks or double clicks occurring closely together in time as a function of state. And I should say this is done under anesthesia, so have that caveat in mind. Anyway, in the desynchronized state, this is an example of a population of neurons responding to a single presentation of a double click with a 50 millisecond ISI and a single click over here. And if you look closely, you can see there's lots of spikes all the way through. But if you look very closely here where the double click is, you can see two vertical stripes, which are the population responding to both clicks. If you look very closely here, you can see one vertical stripe, which is a population responding to one click, and it's followed by some silence, which is the population not responding to the absence of a click. In fact, it goes below baseline in the period after the first click. Now let's look at it in the synchronized state. Here, you see the response to two clicks, and you can no longer see these two fine structured responses. What you see is a much longer period of activity, one of these bursts, that was evoked. And it suggests that the temporal dynamics of the burst itself has interfered with the response to this rapid auditory stimulus. And the same here, where we have a single click, there's certainly it evokes a packet of activity, but it doesn't look very different to that one. So to try and tell them apart, we use a technique of machine learning to try and discriminate whether there was single or a double click from the population activity recorded after the second click or absence of the second click. And what you see here is a scatter plot for baseline versus the first click, where we divide the neurons into two groups rather arbitrarily. And you see the firing rate of group one on the x-axis and group two on the y-axis. And what you can see is in the desynchronized state, we've got a very nice distinction between the two groups. And in the synchronized, in black and gray, in the synchronized state, we've also got a very nice distinction. The click gives us a stronger response to the first click than the baseline activity. So the first click, there's absolutely no problem in either state. And if we use a support vector machine to try and classify what the stimulus was from the baseline, from the response to the first click, we've had no problem at all in either stimulus, in either state, determining whether or not a click was present. The second click, though, it's a different story. In the desynchronized state, we can still see a good separation between the two clouds for the second click present versus the second click absent. But in the synchronized state, the clouds are largely overlapping with each other. So when we come to use the classifier, we can no longer do the prediction as well. We can still do it pretty well in the desynchronized state, but in the synchronized state, the information about the second click just isn't there. So what that suggests is that indeed the temporal dynamics of the brain itself has interfered with the representation of these fine temporal structured stimuli. So to summarize that piece of work, it suggests that the representation of rapid auditory stimuli can be impaired in the synchronized state and is consistent with the hypothesis that LLI represents an inability to fully desynchronize the auditory cortex, and also suggests that if we were able during early language learning to direct children at risk of LLI to desynchronize the auditory cortex, perhaps through cueing or some other way of directing attention to this state, that they would be able to better represent the stimuli, and then perhaps the language learning would be better. And I believe April also has some work that's related to this. So now just at the end, I want to quickly give a plug for a poster by Pierre Iger later today, which is again about the auditory system, but now in a computational model. And the question is, can we model how cortical networks learn to recognize speech? It's rather ambitious, but the surprising thing is it actually works fairly well. So let me tell you the idea. And this is the work of Pierre Iger, who's over there. So when we learn to perceive speech, when babies learn to perceive speech, they learn just by listening. If you have a child, you'll notice that they learn to understand what you're saying long before they learn to speak themselves. There are many times we learn by doing, but learning speech, at least initially, is not one of them. Babies learn speech sounds and phonemes just by passive exposure to these sounds. And in computer science or machine learning, this would be called unsupervised learning. It's when there's no target you've got to do, you're just exposed to a set of stimuli, and the machine or the network of neurons or the brain learns to form a representation of those stimuli that's going to enable the animal or human to guide their behavior. One of the most popular methods of unsupervised learning is independent component analysis. And the point about independent component analysis is it finds non-Gaussian projections of the input. And the thing about this is that by the central limit theorem, if you take any data set and you make a random projection of it, you'll get a Gaussian distribution. But in the real world, physical sources of sounds or other stimuli are non-Gaussian. So if we can find the non-Gaussian projections of the data, then these are more likely to correspond to meaningful physical signals than a Gaussian projection would. And this is very commonly used in machine learning. So could something similar happen in neurons? So we developed something we call the convallis rule, which seeks to do just this. And in particular, the neurons that implement this rule have a plasticity scheme that maximizes the skewness of their membrane potential. It's non-Gaussianity. So technically, what we have is an objective function, f of v, which is a desired, which indicates the membrane potentials the cell wants to have. So it wants to spike, and it wants to be at rest, but it doesn't want to be in between the two. It's happy when it's making up its mind one way or the other. Either it's going to spike, it has a positive f, or it's going to be at rest, it has a positive ref, f, but if it's in the middle, it's not happy with this situation. And when you optimize this function, it causes the membrane potential distribution to become skewed, mainly at rest, occasionally at threshold, and as little time as possible in between, become non-Gaussian. So I won't go through the mathematics, but it's fairly straightforward to derive by gradient descent a plasticity rule saying what the change in synaptic weights should be in order to maximize the integral of f dt. And essentially what comes out of it is the following. Every presynaptic spike, every spike of the presynaptic cell, you convolve with a kernel function which corresponds basically to the EPSP shape in the postsynaptic cell. And if this spike happens just before a time when the cell is strongly depolarized, then that will cause potentiation of the synapse. Whereas if the presynaptic cell fires just before the cell was in this middle area, this danger zone, this will cause a weakening of the synapse. And this actually has been shown that this sort of thing happens in cortical networks, in cortical neurons a long time ago from Tola and Singer, Ban, and many others have shown that this sort of thing happens. But this, in this case, we haven't based it on physiological data. We've derived it from an optimization principle that the cell increases its skewness. And the derivative of this objective function f that we start with is what gives us this curve that makes the cell potentiate synapses at times of depolarization, weaken them at times of moderate depolarization, and do nothing at rest. Okay, so this predicts a lot of things. It predicts spike timing dependent plasticity for the reason that if a presynaptic cell fires just before a spike, then after the presynaptic, F prime will be large during the time of the spike and you'll get potentiation. Whereas if the presynaptic cell fires after a spike, then you'll be in the after depolarization phase of the spike. And in this zone, an F prime will be negative. It predicts spike timing dependent plasticity with fairly close to the bi-exponential curve that we're familiar with. But STDP is not a summary of cortical plasticity. It's not even really a fundamental principle of cortical plasticity. It's just the result of one particular experiment when you have pairs of spikes at different timing. And it's in no way a summary of what cortical plasticity is. And there's a vast number of other paradigms that people have used to test cortical plasticity, including triplets of spikes, pairs of spikes at different intervals, and many more. And for those interested to visit Pierre's poster, you'll see that the Convallis rule does a remarkably good job of predicting a lot of these experimental results. But the interesting thing, though, is what happens when you run it on some speech data. So if we take a database of sounds from the TI Digits database, for those who are interested, and we run it through a time frequency analysis, rather like the cochlea, and then we pass it to one of these neurons, and we run the Convallis rule, what we find is that the neurons develop selectivity for particular digits in the database. So the database consists of the 11 digits, 0 to 9, and also O, because people say both, that have been taken from things people say over the phone. And men, women, and children speaking them. And this example neuron here, without the rule, does no discrimination. But after running the rule, it distinguishes 4 from 5. Even more interesting, if we take a recurrent network of simulated excitatory and inhibitory neurons and run the rule in the excitatory neurons, we find that the population as a whole develops a distributed representation of all the different digits that lets us read out the output with a simple classifier like a support vector machine. And here's the result. We get to about 97% classification performance, cross-validated, running the Convallis rule, whereas spike timing dependent plasticity, if you just implement that alone, hardly does anything. So what this seems to suggest is that STDP is really just a signature of perhaps a more fundamental principle in cortical plasticity. And one possibility for what that is this idea that the neurons are trying to maximize the skewness of their membrane potential distribution, in other words, to find non-Gaussian distributions of the data, rather like independent component analysis. The last thing I want to say about this is another interesting coincidence with work of many people, including Dan Feldman of our own TDLC, which is that the mathematical form of the rule maps directly onto what we think are the molecular mechanisms of cortical plasticity. Not hippocampal plasticity, but cortical plasticity. So remember in the rule, we have this shape here, that moderate potentials lead to depression, high potentials lead to potentiation. And you can express this as a sum of two curves with different thresholds. A curve of low threshold for depression and a curve of high threshold for potentiation. Now, one of the probably the leading mechanistic model of spike timing dependent plasticity, or just of synaptic plasticity, is the calcium concentration hypothesis that says when you have high calcium concentrations in the postsynaptic spine, it leads to LTP. Low concentrations lead to LTD. This is inconsistent with our results. We could not get the behavior that we have from the rule with the calcium concentration. But what does work is to have two separate voltage sensors, a high threshold sensor for LTP and a low threshold sensor for LTD. That's what we would require to get a neuron to do this. And it actually seems that this maps quite well onto the mechanisms that people have shown for cortical but not hippocampal plasticity, which is that the LTP is mediated by the NMDA receptors, whereas LTD, which have a high threshold, LTD is mediated by a different coincidence detector, most likely depending on the coincident activity of metabotropic glutamate receptors and T-type low-threshold voltage-gated channels. Okay, so that's the end of the talk. Just to summarize everything I've said, first, in vivo, oh, and by the way, that last stuff, go to Pierre's poster if you're interested. In vivo, cortical activity has an intricate fine structure. In synchronized states, it's organized into 100 millisecond packets that encode information about stimuli. In desynchronized states, activity is steadier and may allow more faithful representation of rapid auditory stimuli. And finally, this proposed plasticity mechanism causes model networks to represent speech sounds matching phenomena and mechanisms of cortical plasticity. What we want to do next is put it all together and see if after we run this rule, we get data that looks like what we've recorded in vivo. Okay, so thank you all very much for attention, and thanks to everyone who did the work, and I've already named the important people, so I won't go through the list. Thank you.